This podcast delves into the dark, the depraved, and all things to keep you up at night. Listener discretion is advised. Now, sit back, pull the covers over your head, and allow yourself to be taken on a journey through the abyss.
Hey there, pod people. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Through the Abyss podcast. I'm your co-host, Mandy.
And I am an intergalactic space warrior named Ben.
You were thinking that up but I was saying that, right? That's why you took such a long pause.
Actually, just popped in my head. I am that weird that while I was still putting down the Psychology of Emotion book and then fumbling to push got it for the Mandy is trying to record, it just came out.
Oh my goodness. Okay, and today we're going to be talking about a lesser known serial killer, unless you're a paranormal enthusiast, and we'll get into that a little bit more, but his name is Herb Baumeister.
All right, now I'm super curious, unless you're a paranormal person. All right.
You never heard of him, Ben?
No, I have not.
Herb Baumeister? Yeah.
All right.
So Herbert Richard Baumeister was born April 7th, 1947 to Dr. Herbert E. and Elizabeth Baumeister of Indianapolis, and he was the oldest of four kids. His father was an anesthesiologist, and soon after the last child was born, the family moved to the affluent area of Indianapolis called Washington Township. That's where my mom lives, except for not in Indianapolis, in Dayton, Ohio.
I've actually spent tons of time in Indianapolis because my grandparents lived there on my mom's side. So before their passings, yeah, we used to go there every year.
Oh, cool. I like Indianapolis.
By the way, I just randomly noticed, and I don't even remember why, but I was looking up like different medical professions pay rates. Anesthesiologists make loot.
Oh, like, I know.
Crazy loot.
When I was a paramedic, I thought about going back to medical school to be an anesthesiologist.
Yeah.
Primarily because I really like intubating people. I think it's fun and I'm good at it, but
I think you have to go into things like that for the right reason or else you aren't going to make it through med school, right? But like,
I actually did enjoy that side of it. It was my favorite part of it, actually, but yeah, that didn't happen, so I'll just live vicariously through your PhD.
If I survive.
Oh, you'll be fine. You've gotten this far, you can go the rest of the way. So, Mr. Herbert started to obsess over vile, disgusting things. He developed a macabre sense of humor and appeared to lose his ability to judge right from wrong. And rumors started circulating about him urinating on his teacher's desk. Once he actually put a dead crow that he found on the road on his teacher's desk.
How does he not get, I mean, I get that this was in the 40s and probably like anything went back then. I don't know. It was like, I want to say the Wild West. I get that the Wild West was the 1800s, but it was like not 2020 something. But my point is, if a student put a dead crow on their teacher's desk today, I would assume expelled.
Well, yeah, but I mean, they didn't have cameras and stuff. And, you know, after class, after the teacher left, he could have easily snuck back in there and just flopped it on her desk. I mean, he was able to piss on her desk, so.
Yeah, that's true. I guess if there's never proof.
It's security was very lax. It's
definitive that he threw the dead crow, but yeah, okay.
Yeah. So his peers began distancing themselves, obviously, leery of association with that crazy behavior that he's displaying. And in class, he was quite often disruptive and volatile, and his teachers reached out to his parents for help. So his parents also noticed changes in him. They sent him for a medical evaluation, which revealed that Herbert was schizophrenic and suffered from multiple personality disorder. And as far as anybody knows, they didn't seek treatment for him. So let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, I mean, schizophrenia and then dissociative, which multiple is now dissociative personality disorder.
Yeah.
It's like, that would be insane not to get treatment. Mostly, actually, from the schizophrenic standpoint, just because paranoid delusions can often be violent, suicidal, like hearing voices telling you to kill yourself, things that you definitely wouldn't want to just leave unchecked.
Well, and the whole the dissociative identity disorder, I don't know. I mean, with these things going unchecked, I don't see how he was able to function as a regular human being without somebody being like, you need to be locked up.
Well, let's keep in mind, so far we've said dead crow on teacher's desk, peeing on stuff. Nobody wants to associate with him because he's super odd, right? Like, I don't think he was a normally functioning human being, but I think that I was going to say the world is lucky that he just didn't hurt himself, but given the fact that we know he's going to end up being a serial killer, the world probably wasn't so lucky. It's probably bad.
Yeah, his
prison.
Victims will probably disagree with you on that one.
Yes.
So during the 60s, they had the electroconvulsive therapy, the ECT, which was apparently the most common treatment for schizophrenia. And
by the way, they still use it.
I know. I have a family member who tried it for manic depressive disorder.
Yeah, and I have family member that used it as well, and it actually was helpful. I mean, so it's not this horrific thing you see in like Jack Nicholson one. Is it One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
right,
no, the
right.
person who had it in my family was absolutely horrified by it. It didn't help at all. It actually, I think, caused problems.
Yeah, I think it needs to be an extreme point. Like my family member was to the point where they just from depression and trauma didn't know who they were. It was just like a stress induced amnesia, and so it actually made them remember who they were. So I can't see that as a negative.
Yeah, that's interesting, because the person who had it in my family, it actually erased a lot of their memories.
So kind of backwards.
Yeah.
So one thing we can say for sure is it plays with memories.
Well, how could it not? I mean,
yeah,
you got electricity frying your brain. It's got to be frying something. So back to the 60s, people with schizophrenia, they unfortunately were often institutionalized because most people didn't know how to deal with it, obviously. And
it
was
can be life-threatening, obviously, too. So
right. And it was accepted practice to shock unruly patients several times a day.
That I've never heard of.
That's crazy. I mean, they weren't hoping to cure them, but they were just trying to make them more manageable for the hospital staff.
Yeah,
so basically
they're
torturing
to subdue them. Like an animal. It's basically the same as having like an electric fence, right? Anytime the animal goes near the fence, it shocks them and it keeps them subdued and behind the fence.
Mm-hmm.
So your subdue is completely right, I think.
Yeah. But the mid-70s is when drug therapy replaced the ECT, because obviously it was more humane and a lot more productive. And, you know, most patients on drug therapy could lead fairly normal lives. But we still don't know whether or not Herb actually received any kind of drug therapy. So as far as we know, he's living life as a complete and total schizophrenic. And I don't know if he had actual multiple personalities or not. There's just not a whole lot known about him, but we're going to go on the assumption that he was not being treated for anything.
Yeah.
So he continued in public high school. He maintained his grades, but he failed socially. So he was a good student, but had absolutely no social skills. And unfortunately, his school's extracurricular activities were focused on sports, and you know, the members of the football team and their friends, of course, were the most popular people. And Herb,
I'm just laughing because that seriously has not changed a lot. I mean,
no,
I know
it really
you
hasn't.
Like marching bands and like chess teams and what, but look, like our high school football team paid for everything. It brought in all the money.
Ours, I don't know what brought in money for us, because our football team, I don't think, was that good. I don't really remember. I just went like, I had a lot of friends in the marching band, and my friends and I helped with the flag corps. What are the flag people? We're the ones who,
yeah, I know what
during
you're
the
talking about. I think it is corps, drill team, maybe.
Drill team, something like that. They're the ones who walk around, you know, doing the flag
thingies.
Yeah,
there is a word for it. What is it?
Flag guard or something like that. Color guard.
Is it?
I think. I don't. God, they're going to kill me if anybody's listening. Sorry, I can't remember. I'm old, remember? We're old. But no, I was the one who helped put out, you know, the flags, put them in there in certain spots for different parts of routine and stuff like that. I had a blast because I didn't actually have to be in the marching band because I actually do play the trumpet. I played the trumpet since I was in fourth grade, but
I played the trumpet, but I sucked.
Well, I was really good. I actually still am pretty good.
I was real bad. Like at one
Oh.
point, our music director said, "Ben, I appreciate your volume because I played really loud." But he said, "Until you're playing the correct notes, I'd like you to bring it down a bit."
So I'm guessing you weren't first or second chair then, huh?
No, I was always either last or second to last, depending on what me and, forgive me, Miriam, what me and Miriam had going on. Like sometimes it was her, sometimes it was me at the end.
Yeah, I was either first or second chair. But when I got to high school, I just stopped, which was so stupid because I don't know. I don't know. I thought it was too cool.
I
But then
stopped
I
at high school
still.
too, but for a purpose. Our high school, you had to be part of the marching band to stay in band, and I wasn't doing
Oh.
that shit.
You know what? It was actually kind of fun because I lived in Smyrna, Tennessee, like through middle school and then part of ninth grade. And after eighth grade, we had tryouts for the marching band. So I actually made the marching band for Smyrna High School, but then I ended up moving to Cookeville with my grandparents. And technically, ninth grade was still in the junior high.
Yeah, that's how
And
we
they
were
had to
too.
be bussed back, you know, at the end of the day. And I'm like, you know what? This is a hassle. I'm done. So
A
I
lot of
quit.
work. Yeah, we were in the same boat on that.
Yeah.
Yep, sure.
I kind of miss it though. I enjoyed playing. I like playing the
I
trumpet.
wish I knew how to play the trumpet, but I don't think I want to go through band in high school to get to that point. So
No, I'm good with that because it was a lot of hard work, but it's one thing I was actually really good at. So I kind of, but I mean, I ended up hanging out with the marching band all the time anyway because we had to travel with them and go to all the competitions and things like that. So you still got to hang out with my friends and get on the football field during halftime. Just I didn't have to play an instrument, so
yeah.
it's a
I
win-win
will
in
say this.
my opinion.
My sister-in-law played the saxophone. So did my sister, but my sister hasn't tried again. But my sister-in-law is a year older than me, which means she's in our age range. And she just bought a saxophone like a couple years ago and is relearning with a teacher and everything. So you could do it.
You know what? The weird thing is I still remember like the notes and everything for the trumpet. I can still play it perfectly. I have forgotten how to read music though. So I have to
Yeah.
relearn how to read music, but I still remember how to play taps on my trumpet, which is
Yeah, I don't remember what the notes are.
you don't even need,
Yeah.
you don't have to have a note. You can either just do D and just use your embouchure to change your notes or not have anything and you can still play it without doing anything. You're still changing the notes with your embouchure, but you
Wow.
don't actually have to use the thingies, the finger things.
Yeah.
Anyway, we got off topic again.
Yep.
So yeah, we were saying that the football team and of course their friends were the most popular people, you know, like you said, still hasn't changed. And he wanted to be a part of this group, of course, but he was always rejected every time, you know,
So
because
he did try out for teams. Interesting.
I don't know if he actually tried out for the teams. I think he was more just trying to
Trying
get
to
in
socially
good.
interact.
Yeah,
Yeah.
good and good with them. So, you know, he's one of those guys that it was all or nothing. So he either would be accepted into the group or he'd be alone. And unfortunately, he finished his high school year, his final high school year in solitude, which is sad. But given his circumstance, I can understand it. And in 1965, Ballmeister attended Indiana University. Again, he dealt with being an outcast because of his strange behavior, and he dropped out in his first semester. But his dad pressured him, and he returned, excuse me, in 67 to study anatomy. But again, he dropped out before the semester ended. So this time, however, being at IU wasn't a total loss because he met Juliana Sater, a high school journalism teacher and part-time IU student. They started dating and found that they had a lot in common. And besides being extremely conservative politically, they shared an entrepreneurial spirit and dreamed of, you know, one day owning their own business. They got married in 71, but 6 months into the marriage, for unknown reasons, Ballmeister's father had Herbert committed to a mental institution where he was there for 2 months. But his marriage was fine. Juliana was in love with him. And, you know, despite his odd behavior, she chose to stay with him. But
It's
I'm.
interesting though. Like if his dad just like randomly has him committed, we know it's not random. It's like we'll never know what happened, but something did, right?
I'm sure he probably had a mental break. You know, his schizophrenia just got out of control and he had a manic episode or something. Who knows? They're
Yeah.
so damn quiet about everything. It's hard to find anything on this guy. So Herb's father pulled strings and he got Herb a job as a copy boy at the Indianapolis Star. He ran reporter stories between desks and performed other errands, things like that. It was a low-level position, but he dove into it and he was eager to start a new career. Unfortunately, his constant efforts to gain positive feedback from the higher ups became irritating, which I can understand that. You know, he obsessed over ways to fit in with his coworkers, but he never succeeded. You know, he was,
So weird
yeah,
that
he's
he
just,
like that he so much wants to be social.
yeah.
Like I feel like most serial killers, I mean, other than flamboyant people like Ted Bundy, they want to kind of stay by themselves. But I mean, at this point, he's not a serial killer, so maybe this is what
Right.
leads to it. But it's just this guy's super trying to reach out all over the place.
Yeah, which kind of, you know, because you see the same pattern over and over again. Because that's why I kind of, I don't think he had multiple personalities. I think he was just so terribly schizophrenic that, I don't know, maybe it presented different ways. I don't know. I don't know a whole lot about schizophrenia, just that if it goes untreated, it can be bad.
Yeah. And I'd have to look it up, but I don't know how often it's comorbid with multiple personalities, right? Like, I'm
Right.
not sure those go hand in hand often.
Yeah, I have a family member who is schizophrenic, but he is on medication, and I grew up around him a lot, and I don't remember any odd behavior. I mean, he may have been medicated his whole life. I'm not really sure because they don't really talk about it. But I don't remember him being the way he is now. Like now he's very just like lithium state of mind, you know, just very calm, somber, and just there, basically. I don't remember him being like that when he was younger. So old Herbie's trying to fit in. And of course, you know, not being accepted is a little bit got to be a just got to be hurtful, but he couldn't handle his quote unquote nobody status, so he eventually left for a job at the BMV, which is, you know, insert joke here. That is so obvious. I'm not even going to go there. So he began his entry level job there with a different kind of attitude. At the newspaper, he was kind of childlike, overeager. You know, he display those hurt feelings when he didn't get the recognition that he so long wanted. And but at the BMV, he came off as bossy and aggressive toward his coworkers, and he'd lash out at them for no reason, like kind of like he was playing a role or emulating what he perceived as good supervisory behavior. So he's done like a 180. Is that something
Yeah, I'm
indicative of
just
schizophrenia?
doing like a complete life switch.
Yeah, like his whole personality changes.
I mean, to an extent, you could say like there's a possibility he's like hearing voices telling him to do these things. I mean, there are delusions that come. I mean, I think just the fact that he thinks he's a nobody. And this isn't a public service announcement, I promise, where I'm saying everyone is somebody. Everyone is, though. Like,
Yes.
so yes, public service announcement too. But for me, I'm just like, I was so busy thinking about, to me, leaving even an entry position as a journalist to go try to even be like a supervisory position at the BMV is a major step down. So I'm just like, he's got like these delusional views of his own worth and then what will establish that worth. And it's very curious. So
Yeah.
I don't know that he is hearing voices. I mean, schizophrenics do often, but like at least you could say that his views of his perception of himself and his perception of what's going to make him complete and happy are all messed up. They're all delusional.
I mean, keep in mind too, we're going on the assumption that he actually was a schizophrenic.
Yes.
You know, maybe he has just always been a psychopath and his psychopathic tendencies were just showing themselves.
Yes, I mean, and like, because like we were talking about a long time ago, jumping back where he puts the dead crow on his teacher's desk. It's in my mind, I'm like, did he kill the crow? Did he find some roadkill? Right? Like, is he also abusing animals? Then we're talking about how like much he doesn't fit in with anybody. So my mind's instantly like, this lady that he's like gets to fall in love with him, is she weird? Is she weird too? Like, this dude doesn't relate to anybody. How is this lady like? And then also, she's like a high school teacher who's also going back to school. So to me, it's like, I know he dropped out for a couple years, but it's like, are they even like a similar age, or is like she like a mother figure?
I don't know. I mean, from all things that I've read from her, she seemed to be what we would deem normal, you
Yeah, I
know?
mean, she could be a young high school teacher, right? Like
Right, yeah.
a 24-year-old who had
Well, I
gotten her
mean, you think
bachelor's,
70s,
and
yeah. I mean,
right.
teachers there, I mean, there were young teachers because that was just, you know, kids starting to get out on their own, things like that. But
Right. So
yeah.
she probably already has some sort of, well, to teach, she would have some sort of degree, and then she's probably going back for like a master's or something like that. And we know that his return to school, he's going for like anatomy. I don't know if he's completed anything at that point, but that's like a
No.
pre-med type of thing, right? So that's like, they're probably similar ages. It just
Yeah.
seemed like weird. And then it's weird that with all of his lack of ability to connect socially to anybody, that there's this woman that's like, oh yeah, that guy.
Well,
Right.
I
And she's
think,
got her life going on. She's got a
yeah.
career.
She's, I have a lot of questions about her because
Yeah.
they were married for like, I think, I want to say like 25 years, something like that. And I read an interview that she gave where she said in the 25 years they were married, they only had sex like six times.
Yeah. So either she's cheating on him left and right at that point, or she's
No,
got.
I don't think she was.
Well, that's what I say, or she's got something too, because I get it, it's long time ago in the 67, but I mean honestly, the 60s, that's like the free love movement. It's like,
Well, this was the 70s that they were
right.
together,
So
yeah.
it's past that. Okay. But my only point is that I feel like there's gotta be something emotionally, psychologically wrong with her
Oh,
to
yeah.
only have had sex six times in that long. I mean, if she's not out doing stuff behind his back.
Yeah, I mean,
I
or she's
mean,
just one of those old-fashioned, you know, well, I'm married, I can't do anything else, you know, it is what it is type of thing. I don't know. It's just
I don't
she, it's
know.
very
I mean,
odd.
when I'm not dating people, I can go a couple years here and there in between. And so, I
I'm
mean,
not even going to tell you how long it's been for me,
it's
so
been,
I don't even
yes,
think
that's
about
what I say. It's been a long time for me
that.
too. But the whole point of that was just that I'm not with somebody. If they were in the bed beside me, I
Yeah.
couldn't just not have physical contact forever.
Well, spoiler alert, Herb's gay. He likes gay men. So that's why I wasn't getting it done with her, I'm assuming. So,
Yeah.
all right. So even though he had this, like, tried to put on this supervisory, you know, aggressive behavior, he was still considered an oddball. You know, his behavior was erratic. His sense of propriety was at times way off. One year, he sent a Christmas card to everyone at work that pictured him with another man, both dressed in holiday drag. Now, this is the early 70s. So
Yeah,
we know where
so
mindsets are. Nobody found that funny. Like, you know, you,
no, nobody's digging that.
yeah, there's no joking around with homosexual behavior. People did not understand it. They certainly didn't like it. So yeah, this. He wants to win people over, but he does shit like this. So I don't know. This there, yeah. There, I mean, there's definitely something wrong with this guy.
I mean, I almost feel like putting the dead crow on his teacher's desk could have been a way to try to endear to the teacher, like when the cat drops off the dead animal
Oh
on the
yeah, well,
floor.
true. But he also peed on a desk. But
I
if we
mean,
think of it in
marking
terms of
territory. She's
dogs,
my
marking the
teacher.
yeah, marking the territory. Oh God.
She might have been sitting at the desk when it happened. We don't know.
Oh Lord, I guess it all depends on how what's going on in his head. After 10 years, despite his poor relationship with his coworkers, he was recognized as an intelligent go-getter who produced results and was promoted to program director. But in
Yeah.
1985, within a year of the promotion that he had so wanted to have, he was terminated after he urinated on a letter addressed to the then governor Robert D. Orr. And the act substantiated rumors about who was responsible for urine found months earlier on his manager's desk. Wonder who did that.
That sounds like wouldn't have been him.
What is with the urinating, though?
I mean, I don't know.
That's crazy, right?
I mean, clearly it's just extreme disrespect. Like, I was kidding, obviously, when I said he's marking territory.
Yeah.
Although it
kind of seems like it.
It could be. But then when you're saying it was the governor's letter?
Yeah. I guess he didn't like the governor.
He probably just hates the governor, right? And then he probably hates his boss, hates mm-hmm. the teacher, hates authority. Well, clearly all of those are people in authority figures, right?
Yeah.
They're so positions of authority. He doesn't like people telling him what to do. That's why he has to be a go-getter, because he's got to climb the ladder so there's no one telling him what to do. What he doesn't know is there's a long way to the top, and the higher you get, the people
right further you fall.
Are worse.
Yeah,
worse
yeah.
And worse.
Yeah, corporate America, the higher you get, the worse they are.
Yes.
I'm convinced that all CEOs are sociopaths or psychopaths. I'm really convinced.
I mean, it's got to be – you got to be a special kind of person to sit – at a desk, or right now probably mostly at your home, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're working from mm-hmm. home, and just put down this is what we're going to do as a company, and it affects so many lives except your own, because you're not going to be doing any of that.
Yeah, no. The problem I have, and you know, I don't have anything against people wanting to obtain massive amounts of wealth. I mean, I want to be rich too. I have a problem with the CEOs making millions upon millions of dollars when they're paying the people who are actually running the company shit. That's what I have a problem with.
Yeah. And I'm sure they're not all bad, for sure.
Well, I'm sure, no, because, well, like, take Richard Braniff of, I guess, Braniff Air, right?
Wasn't he Virgin?
Yeah, Virgin Air. He's supposed to be one of the best bosses in the world. Like, I think he even gave up a year of his salaries to make sure his employees were getting...
Yeah, there are good ones out there.
Yeah, there are good ones. I'm just saying, I think a lot of them are sociopaths.
Yeah.
Not all, but yeah. Maybe, not all. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, Baumeister, clearly not like an authority.
No. No, no, no. So it's been 9 years into their marriage, and him and his wife started a family. Marie was born in 79, Eric was 1981, and Emily was 1984. And before Herb lost his BMV job, things were going well. So his wife quit her job to become a full-time mom, but of course had to return to work when Herb couldn't find any steady work after he lost his job. So as a temporary stay-at-home dad, he apparently was caring and loving to his kids, but being jobless left too much time on his hands, and unknown to his wife, he began drinking a lot and hanging out at gay bars. My question is, where the hell are the kids while he's doing all this shit?
Wait, how many kids does he have?
Three.
They only had sex six times in their marriage, so three of them resulted in children?
Yeah.
Half of them?
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
Lord. Oh, Lord. These might not be his kids. Do they look like him?
I don't know. I've never seen pictures of them. Oh, gosh, that's funny.
I would be questioning if we only had sex six times.
I don't know. Maybe his boys are just really rampant.
I guess.
In September of 85, he received a slap on the hand after being charged in a hit-and-run accident while driving drunk. 6 months later, he was charged with stealing a friend's car and conspiracy to commit theft, but beat both of those charges. I don't understand how he was able to do that. He a hit-and-run while he was drunk, and he got a slap on the wrist. That doesn't happen.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking the only way that could happen is if very little damage was done to the person he hit.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true. Even if it may not have been even a person. He may have just, like, hit another car and took off. So
right, that's what I mean. A person in a car is what I meant. Like, and it was probably small damage, that it wasn't, like, whatever lump of sum it would be to make it a more egregious crime, and then the person probably wasn't hurt.
I would hope. God, the drunk driving, though.
What's that?
Hell, drunk driving now. God, if you get caught drunk driving, you lose your license.
It's bad. Like, I mean, he could have killed somebody. So, yeah, it's bad. But I'm thinking the only way he probably got a slap on the wrist is it was probably such minimal damage that nobody was fighting it, right? You don't have a victim like screaming, "I'm in the hospital. What's going on with this?"
Yeah,
And
yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, they may not have pressed charges or whatever, but yeah. He got lucky on both counts though. So they locked him up. There might not have been this as many problems. So he was bouncing between jobs until he began working at a thrift shop. And he at first considered the job beneath him, but he kind of started to realize it was a potential moneymaker. And over the next 3 years, he really focused his time on learning the business. And it was during this time that his father died. And nobody knows what kind of effect it had on Herbert. I mean, his dad's the one who was always pushing him and committed him to a mental hospital. So
It's
I'm thinking
clearly
it may
there.
not have affected him that much.
Maybe, but he's also one of the few people that's like involved.
No, true. That's true. I wish people were able to. I wish he did interviews, but we'll find out later why there's none around. All right. So 1988, borrowing $4,000 from his mom, he and his wife opened a thrift store, which they named Save-A-Lot, which I've actually shopped at several of those.
Yeah, they're all over, right?
Yeah, they are. Well, I guess they used to be. I don't know if they still are or not. That was kind of like an 80s, 90s thing. They may not be around anymore.
That's crazy.
So they stock theirs with gently used quality clothing, furniture, and other, used items. And a percentage of the store's profit went to the Children's Bureau of Indianapolis, and their business boomed, which I think is awesome. Awesome that, they gave some of their profits to charity.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. Just never knew the founder of Save-A-Lot was a serial killer.
Right? Yeah. So their profits were so strong in the first year that they opened a second store, and within 3 years, after all that time of living paycheck to paycheck, they were making bank. So this is where Fox Hollow Farms comes in. Have you ever heard of that?
Have not.
As a paranormal investigator, you've never heard of Fox Hollow Farms. I'm disappointed.
I have not.
All right. Well, we'll
But you
talk
know
about
I'm a shitty paranormal investigator.
it.
I was there for the fun and the camaraderie
Yeah, I know. And sleeping.
and sleeping. I'm like the only one of our team that would just accidentally fall asleep in haunted locations because hella tired.
Yeah, he
Keep in
took a
mind
nice
back then,
nap.
though, I was working nights, which should mean that I would be better off staying up all night. But on the weekends, my schedule would totally flip. And
Yeah.
at
He'd
least
sleep most of the
here,
time.
I've kept my schedule the same. I get up at like 4 in the morning, 3 in the morning,
Ugh.
whatever, no matter what day it is.
No, thank you. In 1991, the Baumeisters moved to their dream home, which was an 18-acre horse ranch called Fox Hollow Farms in the upscale Westfield area, which is just outside of Indianapolis in Hamilton County. The large, beautiful million-dollar semi-mansion had all the bells and whistles. It had a stable. It even had an indoor pool. And remarkably, Herb had actually become a well-respected, successful family man who gave to charity. So he's gotten, like, finally he's gotten the accolades and the friendships and all that crap that he actually wanted, surprisingly enough.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, stress from working so closely together, he and his wife, soon followed. And from the start of the business, Herb had treated Juliana like an employee, and he often yelled at her for no reason. But to keep the peace, she took a backseat on business decisions. So she's one of those. But, it took a toll on their marriage. They argued and separated on and off, over the next several years. Now, the Save-A-Lot stores had a reputation for being very clean, very organized, but the opposite could be said about their new home.
It's weird.
So the grounds used to be very, very well maintained, but after they moved in, they became overgrown with weeds. Inside, the rooms were a mess. Housekeeping apparently was not a priority at all. But the only area that Baumeister seemed to care about was a pool house, and he kept the wet bar stocked, and he filled the area with a extravagant decor, which included mannequins that he dressed and positioned to give the appearance of a lavish pool party. That's not creepy at
All
all.
day pool party, yeah.
Yeah. And now, to escape the turmoil, Juliana and her kids would often stay with Herb's mother at her Lake Wawasee condominium. And Herb stayed behind, of course, to quote unquote run the stores. And that's what his wife believed. I think his wife is just choosing to overlook a lot, you know,
I
she's
mean,
just.
she's very much a sad story. Like, she's got this loveless marriage. She's got this dude yelling at her constantly and treating her more like an employee than than a wife, let
And a
alone a
partner,
human
yeah.
being. And they live in this lavish mansion, but she has to go to the condominium with her kids to escape the lavish mansion because it's such a shithole there because of this dude, right? Like, yeah, it's not a, I don't envy her.
Yeah, no, I don't either. In 94, their 13-year-old son Eric, he was playing in a wooded area behind their home when he found a partially buried human skeleton. He showed it to his mom, who then showed it to Herbert. Now, Herb told her that his father had used skeletons in his research and that after finding the one while cleaning the garage, he just buried it. And surprisingly enough, his wife bought that.
That's crazy, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's lucky that his dad was in the medical field and he could throw that together
Yeah, but
because,
his dad was an anesthesiologist. What the
yeah,
hell does
there's
he
no
need for
reason for him to have.
skeletons?
I mean, maybe when he was in med school, he's still got to do everything else,
Well,
right? But
yeah, but God.
yeah, I
But
mean,
yeah, but his dad keeps him though. Come on.
right. But you also brought up a good point earlier. Throughout the whole marriage, she's living in this fantasy life, right? Like,
Yeah, she
she's
has to
got
be.
to survive it. She's not think she doesn't want to know her husband's not really loving her and that he's gay and he doesn't even probably like women at all. He
Yeah.
doesn't she doesn't want to face him, so she's leaving to go to her parents. Like, and she's if he tells her some fantasy about this skeleton, it's easier than losing her husband, losing her life, and you know, I mean, her
Yeah.
life would have to change. I mean, now looking back, and if we were a friend talking to her, we would be like, turn him into the fucking police or I'm gonna do it, right? Like,
Yeah.
or
You
at
know,
least tell the police about the skeleton, right?
I wonder if she even knew he was gay. I wonder if
Yeah, I don't know.
he, you know, exhibited any kind of those
I find it hard to believe
signs
that
to
she
her.
wouldn't, because even though he's got the mannequins and he's doing this fake pool party, whatever, I would imagine when they're out of town, he's also bringing men over. Assuming he's social enough to get one. I don't know.
Oh, we're getting to that. So, not long after the second store opened, their business actually began to lose money. He started drinking during the day and acting belligerently to his customers and employees. And soon his stores pretty much looked like his house did. They looked like shit. At night, unknown to his wife, he cruised the gay bars and then retreated to his pool house, where apparently he spent hours crying like a child about the dying business. She, you know, his wife obviously was exhausted from worry. Bills were piling up. Her husband was acting stranger and stranger every day. So it sounds like he's kind of slipping into another schizophrenic turmoil period.
Yeah. And I know that Save-A-Lot's like ended up being all over the place. But if you have a store and it's booming, then you set up a second store and all of a sudden you're in super debt and it's not booming, what do?
You close the second one.
You close the second one and you continue to boom with the first one. Like,
Yeah.
I don't know why he's just crying in a pool house.
Well, because I mean, I don't think he really.
At this point, he's drunk and emotionally messed up and
There,
not trying to put the work in, right?
I don't think there's any way his personality or personality disorder, I should say, is going to allow him to be successful.
Yeah,
And his
that's fair.
wife's too meek to stand up and do anything to, you know, she can't take the reins or anything like that to fix it. So they're just kind of in a standstill, you know. So while they were trying to fix their failing business and, you know, in their marriage too, a major murder investigation was underway in Indianapolis. In 1977, Virgil Vandegrift, a highly respected retired Marion County sheriff, opened Vandegrift and Associates Inc., which was a private investigation firm in Indianapolis specializing in missing person cases. In June of 94, Vandegrift was contacted by the mother of 28-year-old Alan Broussard, who she said was missing. When she had last seen him, he was headed to meet his partner in a popular gay bar called Brothers, but he never came home. Almost a week later, Vandegrift received a call from another distraught mother about her missing son. In July, Roger Goodlett, 32, had left his parents' home to go to a gay bar in downtown Indy, but never returned. Or he actually never arrived at the bar. Broussard and Goodlett, they shared a lifestyle. They kind of looked alike. They were near the same age, and they had both vanished en route to a gay bar. So we're getting a type here.
Yeah, it's very Dahmer-esque.
Yes, very much so. Vandegrift distributed missing persons posters at gay bars around the city. Family members and friends of the young men and customers at gay bars were interviewed. Vandegrift learned that Goodlett was last seen willingly entering a blue car with Ohio plates. Vandegrift also received a call from a gay magazine publisher who told Vandegrift that several gay men had disappeared in Indy over the previous few years. Convinced that they were pretty much dealing with a serial killer, Vandegrift took his suspicions to the Indianapolis Police Department. Unfortunately, missing gay men were apparently a very low priority, and possibly the men had left the area without telling their families to freely practice their gay lifestyles. Isn't that lovely? Had they just paid attention and looked into it, there could have been prevention of several people losing their lives. Fucking police departments. So, have you ever heard of the I-70 murders, the I-70 murderer?
I want to say no because it sounds familiar as a title, but I don't know anything about it.
Okay. So this Vandegrift guy also learned about an ongoing investigation into multiple murders of gay men in Ohio that began in 89 and ended kind of mid-90s. Bodies had been dumped along Interstate 70 and were dubbed the I-70 murders in the media. And four victims, they were from Indianapolis.
Yeah,
So
I just want to throw out there because obviously I lived there for a while, and you are had lived in a while in that area. It's like the tri-state area. What's Indianapolis? Maybe an hour and 45 minutes from Cincinnati, Ohio.
About that,
Like,
yeah.
yeah. So Indiana and Ohio, Indianapolis and Ohio are pretty close.
Yeah, they're actually very close. Easy driving distance. Now, weeks after this Vandegrift guy distributed the posters, he was contacted by Tony, and this is not his real name because he didn't want to give it out his real name, who said he was certain that he had spent time with a person responsible for Goodlett's disappearance. Tony said he went to the police and the FBI, and of course, they disregarded him. So Vandegrift set up a series of interviews, and this weird story kind of unfolded. So Tony said he was at a gay club when he noticed another man who seemed overly captivated by the missing persons poster of his friend, Roger Goodlett. As he continued to watch the man, something in his eyes convinced Tony that the guy had information about Goodlett's disappearance. So, to try to learn more, Tony introduced himself. The man said his name was Brian Smart, and he was a landscaper from Ohio. Now, when Tony tried to bring up Goodlett, Smart became evasive. So, obviously, Smart is Herbert. We're that's kind of obvious here. As the
I
evening
wonder if
progressed,
this kind of stuff is why they're like saying multiple personalities when it's like clearly he's just using a fictitious name because he doesn't want to get caught, right?
It could be. It could be. But yeah, that doesn't scream multiple personalities to me. That's just
No.
him trying to keep from being caught because,
Right.
he wants to kill
I
people.
mean, he got caught staring at this poster, right? Like a creeper. He's got to be someone else.
Oh, gosh. As the evening progressed, Smart invited Tony to join him for a swim at a house where he was temporarily living, doing landscape for the new owners who were away. A likely story. But Tony actually agreed and he got into Smart's Buick, which had Ohio plates. Tony wasn't familiar enough with the northern Indianapolis, so he couldn't say where the house actually was, but he described the area as having horse ranches and large homes. He also described a split rail fence and a sign that read farm something. The sign was at the front of the driveway that Smart had turned into. If you were going into somebody's, that you didn't know's home, wouldn't you notice the name of the place you're going into, especially if it's like written over the road that you're traveling under? Like
I
I would
mean,
notice something that said Fox Hollow Farms. I would farm that was Fox Hollow would stand out to me more than farm.
I would think, but the whole point of this dude's story is that he super suspects this guy has information about his missing friend. You think you'd be
More
like looking
attentive.
at everything. Yeah,
Yeah.
like you think that that would be the primary goal, and you'd want to keep alert because
Yeah.
if this dude has anything to do with your friend being missing, then You're in danger now.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Tony described a large Tudor home, which he and Smart entered to through a side door. And he described the interior of the home was being packed with furniture and boxes. He followed, followed Smart through the house and down steps to the bar and pool area, which had mannequins, of course, set up around the pool. Smart offered Tony a drink, which he turned down. Smart guy.
I mean, so, you got mannequins all around you dressed up at the pool. You don't take the drink. That's
Yeah, I'm thinking not. Yeah, probably not. Smart actually excused himself, and when he returned, he was a lot more talkative. And Tony suspected that he'd probably done some cocaine or something like that. At some point, he brought up autoerotic asphyxiation, which is receiving pleasure while choking or being choked out, and asked Tony to do it to him. Tony went along and choked Smart with a hose while he masturbated. Smart then said it was his turn to do it to Tony. Again, Tony went along. Why? I don't know. And as Smart began choking him, it apparently became obvious that he wasn't going to let go. So Tony pretended to pass out. Smart released the hose. But when he opened his eyes, Smart became rattled. And he said he was scared because Tony had passed out. Okay. So, I mean, this guy's pretty good about thinking on his feet. I will give him that.
Yeah.
So, Tony apparently was a lot larger than Smart. So, probably assuming that's why he survived, because he was able to, you know, overpower him if need be. He also refused the drinks that Smart had prepared early in the evening, which I'm sure he had laced with something. So,
oh, for sure,
Smart
yeah.
drove Tony back to Indianapolis, and they agreed to meet again the following week. And to learn more about Smart, Vandegrift arranged to have Tony and Smart followed at their second meeting, but Smart never showed up. So, believing Tony's story, this Vandegrift guy turned again to the police, but this time he contacted Mary Wilson. Now, she was a detective who worked in missing persons, and I guess this Vandegrift, I guess they had a relationship, and he really respected her, whatever, but she drove Tony to the wealthy areas outside Indy, hoping that, you know, he might be able to recognize the house that Smart took him to, but he wasn't able to. So Tony met Smart again. This is a year later when they happened to stop at the same bar. He got Smart's license plate number, which he gave to Wilson. So good for that. And she found that the plate was registered to none other than Herbert Ballmeister. Surprise, surprise. As Wilson discovered more about Ballmeister, she agreed with Vandegrift. Tony had pretty much narrowly escaped becoming the victim of a serial killer. So he got really lucky.
Yeah.
Now, Wilson went to the store to confront Herb, telling him that he was a suspect in an investigation into several missing men, and she asked that he let investigators search his home. He, of course, refused, and he told her in the future that she should go through his lawyer, which, you know, is smart on his part. You know,
if yeah, I was killing people, I wouldn't give. Especially when you have skeletons and
shit. Yeah, yeah, no, and he has bodies buried.
Yeah.
So Wilson then went to his wife, and she told her what her husband was doing, and she was hoping to get her to agree to a search. And of course, Juliana was apparently shocked, but she also refused to let them search. This poor woman. Lord have mercy.
I mean, you got to feel like her thing is she doesn't want to be alone, but it's like, how much of a husband do you really have? Like,
yeah, right.
Probably exactly. Better for her if he gets arrested and she gets this big house back.
Yeah, well, I don't know if she'd want it, but yeah. When she refused, Wilson tried to get Hamilton County officials to issue a search warrant, but they refused, saying there wasn't enough conclusive evidence to warrant it. They did this several times, and throughout this time, they were trying to get warrants, and this Hamilton County was denying it. More people are being killed, so fuck Hamilton County officials for being stupid. So Ballmeister appeared to suffer an emotional breakdown over the next 6 months. By June, Juliana, she'd reached her limit, and the Children's Bureau actually canceled the contract with Save-A-Lot, and they faced bankruptcy. So the fairy tale that they'd been living had began to dissipate, and, you know, her loyalty kind of went along with it. Now, that image of the skeleton that her son had discovered 2 years earlier had never left her mind, and which, how could it, you know, because you have to be thinking something, right?
And the reason it's not leaving her mind, though, is because she knew it was something, like, I don't know.
There's
I
something
mean,
nefarious going on. She had to
yeah,
know.
I don't
She
want to
had
like
to know.
judge her. I don't know what
Yeah.
she was going through, but like you should have told.
That's a huge fucking red flag. Come
Yeah.
on. It's not like BTK where he was very good at hiding that alter ego he had. Because I
Right.
believe his family when they say they had no clue. Her, I don't know. I think
Right.
she
Well,
probably knew something.
this skeleton was by their mansion, right?
It was buried on their property, yeah.
Right. So like his dad would have been nowhere near there with if
Well,
he had.
Herb claimed that he had found it while he was cleaning out his dad's garage, and then he decided to bury it.
Why wouldn't you bury it by your dad's garage at your dad's house?
Yeah, why
You're
would
gonna
you
take
take it
that
home?
home?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. But that's a story he told her, and she bought it. So,
Yeah. I mean,
you
yeah.
know.
The story, I wasn't even thinking of that portion when you said it. It's like even dicier now that she believed
Yeah.
it, because it's like, why did you drive? I don't know how far away he lived from his parents, but why would you drive it from there to there?
Right, exactly. There's so many red flags with him. I think she kind of chose not to look and not to see things.
Yeah.
She had to have. Or maybe she was just so traumatized, that kind of, I mean, she wasn't a battered woman. He didn't abuse her like that, but
I mean, that we know of. We know that he's
well, yeah, that we
verbally
know of,
abusive,
yeah.
so he's not nice to her. And she's spending tons of time at her own family's house, right?
Actually,
Her mom.
it's Herb's mom's house that they spend time
Oh,
at.
he's staying at the in-laws. Okay. Or
She's
she's
staying
staying
at
at
the
the
in-laws.
in-laws. Yeah,
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
with the kids. So I guess his mom
So
was nice. So,
the mom might be protecting her son too. She might
well,
be like
yeah.
telling her all these red flags, and she's like, oh, no, that probably was from my husband. He went to medical school, and you know, like. We don't know what kind of advice she's getting from
Yeah.
mom.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true. So with that crazy image of the skeleton, still in her mind, she decided to file for divorce, and she also decided to tell Wilson about the skeleton. So she would also let detectives search the property. Now, Herbert and Eric were visiting Herbert's mom at Lake Wawasee, and when they were gone, Juliana picked up the phone and called her lawyer. Smart lady, finally. On June 24th, 1996, Wilson and three Hamilton County officers walked onto the grassy area next to the Baumeister's patio. As they looked closely, they could see that the small rocks and pebbles were like where the Baumeister kids played were bone fragments. How can you not notice that? Your
Yeah.
kids are playing with bone fragments and you guys, come on. You know, and of course, forensics came in and they confirmed that they were human bones.
He
Come
said she lived
on.
in a fantasy land. Or she's got her
That's.
own issues. Maybe she doesn't have a lot of time to even watch these kids. We don't know. Like, she's not like the. I'm not saying that she's not, because I don't know. But I'm saying we don't know that she's like the perfect mother,
Yeah,
but that
true.
she's just going through this bad merit, right? Like,
Yeah.
they could all be detached here. Who knows?
That's true. That's very true. So. After finding out, well, when forensics confirmed that they were actual human bones, the following day, police and firemen began excavation. Apparently, bones were everywhere. They were even on the neighbor's land. Early searches found 5,500 bone fragments and teeth. And they estimated that the bones were from 11 men, though only four victims could be identified. Goodlett, who was 34, Stephen Hale, 26, Richard Hamilton, 20, and Manuel Resendez, who is 31. So, of course, his wife begins to panic, which she should have done years ago. She feared for the safety of Eric, who was, you know, with Herb at that time, you know, and authorities did too. So, Herbert and Juliana were in the beginning stages of divorce, and it was decided that before the discoveries at their house hit the news, Herbert would be served with custody papers demanding that Eric be returned to Juliana. So when he was served, he turned over Eric without any kind of incident. And I guess he was just figuring that it was just a legal maneuver.
Yeah.
So once news of the bones discovery was broadcast, Herb vanished. On July 3rd, his body was discovered inside his car at Pinery Park, Ontario, Canada. Herb apparently had shot himself in the head. He left a 3-page suicide note explaining why he took his life, citing problems with the business and his failing marriage. And there was no mention of the murder victim scattered across his
It has
backyard.
nothing to do with the 5,500 bone fragments in my
Yeah,
yard.
nothing to do
That's
with
just circumstantial.
killing 11 people, you know. Never admitted to it, but with Giuliana's help, investigators of the Ohio murders of gay men pieced together evidence that linked Herb to the I-70 murders. So he's also the I-70 murderer. His wife provided receipts showing that Herb actually had traveled I-70 during the times that the bodies were found along the interstate. Now,
Wow.
bodies had stopped appearing beside the highway about the same time that Herb moved into Fox Hollow Farms, where there was plenty of land to hide them. So with him, you know, killing himself, taking the easy way out, we never got any kind of interviews or anything like that, which is sad because I would have loved to have heard him talk about it. But jumping into the paranormal for a minute, Fox Hollow Farms is actually reported to be haunted by Herb himself and some of his victims. People have gone there and done EVPs and heard, you know, there's actually a decent documentary. I think it's on Amazon. I think it's called Fox Hollow Farms documentary, something like that. But it's decent, you know. I take paranormal documentaries with a grain of salt because I wasn't there, so I can't prove that they're, you know, being truthful or whatnot. But it's a decent one. But they apparently were able to contact him and talk to him, and I don't know. It's one place that's on my bucket list to go. Apparently, they don't let people investigate there anymore, but I'm hoping since we've done an episode on this guy that I might be able to sneak in, not sneak in,
Yeah.
with their permission, slip in and, you know, at the very least, interview them and go see the pool.
I was
Because
saying, it sounds like you might actually be able to have things happen if you could just get in the yard. You don't even necessarily need
well,
a
they've
knife.
actually seen apparitions in the yard,
Yeah.
like walking around the woods and stuff where the bodies and stuff were found. So
Here's a question. Do you know like what he was doing to the bodies? Because how do you turn 11 people into 5,500 bone fragments?
I don't know. Dude must have been like chopping them up
Like
and
a wood grinder or something?
had
Or
to
a
something like
chipper?
that. Yeah. For there to
Yeah.
be that many bone fragments from 11 people. That's a lot. I mean, that's like he had to be putting them through a wood grinder or something like that, a wood
Yeah,
chipper.
my guess is that after his wife found the skeleton, that he started
Well, his kid
making.
did, but yeah.
Or his kid did, yeah. He started being a little bit more aggressive with trying to not make them look not like bodies.
Yeah, I don't. What kills me is that he didn't bury him. I mean, he just I for put him through whatever he put him through to, you know,
Throw him
get
in the
him.
gravel pit.
Yeah.
And
Oh, hey kids, have fun playing
in
out
his
there amongst
neighbor's
all the
yard?
bodies.
What is he doing? Just chucking buckets of rock or buckets of bone over the fence? What's
I have no idea. I
that?
mean, like, and what's he doing with the flesh, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like my mind was thinking that it's like, where's all the blood? Where's the skin? Like,
Because
so
I mean,
he had to be burying the flesh so that it would
he had to do
disintegrate.
something because animals don't eat everything off of a bone. Like they don't pick the bones clean.
I
So,
never thought of animals. I wonder
you
if they
know,
had any sort of pets, like pigs or. It is a farm, right?
is a farm, but I don't think they had any animals.
Yeah.
Pigs wouldn't eat the bones. No, goats might.
No, but they say like hog, they always look at hog farms for like murderers because
Well,
they
you can
eat
get rid of a
almost
body.
everything.
Yeah. I mean that could be. But I mean still, you would think you would notice pigs carrying around human parts in their
Yeah.
mouths. You know, I don't
Yeah.
know.
The main reason I thought of the pig farm though was just when we were doing the Molly Tibbetts case, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They thought that a hog farmer who happened to also have like he was on the sexual offenders list and he had a hog farm. They thought he was the initial suspect. So because they said it could have gotten rid of the, but then they found her body anyway, obviously, so she wasn't
Yeah.
eating on a hog farm.
Nope, she
Makes
wasn't eating
sense.
my hog, that's for sure. But these poor people may have been.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a mystery. I mean, I would love it's a closed case, so I don't know if we can see the police reports. I know
Yeah.
you I know they won't let you for things that are ongoing, but
Yeah. But in this guy also, until Save-A-Lot started struggling, he was rich as hell, right? So, I mean,
Yeah.
he could have all manners of equipment, like wood chippers, and I don't, like I said, I don't know what you'd use to get rid of the flesh, but whatever's possible, he could buy.
Acid baths. That's the only thing I could think of.
Acid baths. You know? That's a good possibility.
But don't those eat the bones too? Don't it deteriorate the
I
bones?
I think if they're in there long enough, I think.
Hmm.
The only things that I've seen from the true crime I've watched on acid baths, I think Dahmer had some too, right? Where the bodies weren't fully gone. So like it hadn't been there long enough.
But
So
there's never.
I would assume if it's in there forever that, yeah.
Well, there's never anything come out as, you know, him having any kind of acid vats or anything like that. So it's, I don't know what the hell he did with these people.
Yeah.
I mean, we know he strangled him in the pool because that was where his thing was. That was his sexual gratification. But it's crazy. I mean, they have to have some kind of idea. There's just nothing on it. And it's really annoying.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you for joining us. That will wrap up this episode on Herb Baumeister. As always, I am still an intergalactic warrior named Ben.
And I'm just a regular human being named Mandy. So actually, I'm a superb paranormal investigator, Mandy. We'll go with that.
Nice.
I like that title better.
Nice. I mean, intergalactic warriors are cooler, but whatever floats your boat.
And as always, if you want to get in touch with us, all of our social media links are now in one fun-filled place, www.throughtheabysspodcast.com. Well, Ben, we got another episode under our belts. Thanks so much for tuning in to Through the Abyss podcast. And until next time, keep it weird.
Spooky stuff.